your mercy and grace that you give to us and give it to others. Amen.
Thanks, Dave. Can everybody hear me on the wireless mic? There we go. Good morning, everybody. Yes, Mara. You have a question already? I haven't said anything.
Yeah, that was the first thing I did.
You were so worried about whether I had the sheet that you missed it.
That was the first thing I said. Sometimes I'll have to say a little bit louder. A lot of times your people are still eating it while I'm drinking.
Well, I'm going to be talking this morning about near-death experiences. Something we haven't, I don't think, talked about in this class before. But before I do, I want to say a couple of things. First of all, the Casa de Dios trip is one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. This was my third trip, and it consisted of, we started our day, I met Mark Durham at his house at 5 in the morning on Friday morning, and we were in Tijuana working by, 8:30, 9 o'clock? Yeah. And by 3:30, okay, check this out. From 8:30, we started working at 8:30. We started framing. There was a concrete slab there. By 3:30, it was framed, sided, and pretty much drywalled on the inside. 21 people working like maniacs. And, don't forget the roof. The roof was on, too. So it's very impressive. And you really don't realize, you're 1 mile on this side of the border, and it looks like everywhere else in the United States. You go 1 mile on the other side of the border, and it is third world. There's trash everywhere. There's no landscaping. People are living in cardboard and little tiny houses, and there's no architecture to speak of. It's just depressing. But these people are so full of love, and they care about their families. The family that let me tell you this. Here's the rules for how CASA works. There is a pastor down in Mexico who we work through. We're just one very small cog in the wheel of Baja Christian Ministries. There's many churches in the United States that raise money to build a house. People volunteer. They go down there. But at any one point in time, there's 4, 5, 6 houses on a weekend being built down there through Baja Christian Ministries. And there's a pastor down there who has a house up on a bluff. And every time I'm down there, he's added another dormitory or another set of wonderful bathrooms and showers where the hot water didn't work this time.
Refreshing.
Yeah, the cold shower is refreshing. Yeah. But here's how it works. The people apply to Baja Christian Ministries for a house. There's two requirements. They have to own the property, which was typically, the property that we were on was maybe 30 by 80, 60, yeah, something like that. It's a pretty small lot. And here's the interesting thing. The property has to be in the wife's name. Because what will the husband do with a house? He might gamble it away or get drunk. So it has to be in the woman's name. Apparently they had problems with it before. So anyway. So we go down there, we build this house, and the most rewarding moment is the moment that we hand over the keys of the new house to the people who now own this house. The family that we went down there to build for, husband and wife, four children, a 15-year-old daughter, 8-year-old daughter, 7-year-old daughter, maybe, and twins 2 years old. And they were living in a barely framed building, maybe 8 by 8. There was enough room in there for a single bed for the husband and wife, a refrigerator and a stove, and maybe a little chair. The children couldn't even sleep in there. They slept in another, we never did figure out where they slept, somewhere else. And
in a bathroom.
Yeah.
Whatever that was.
And we built a house for them that was probably a little less wide than this room, and maybe from the center to about here. It's about most of the size of a 2-car garage. Okay? But it has a room that is a living room and a kitchen, and then two bedrooms, and then above the bedrooms is a loft for the kids to sleep. This is palatial compared to what they were used to. And then we brought down a whole bunch of gifts, so there's this whole room full of gifts, bicycles and carpeting and curtains and stuff they have never seen before. This must be the most monumental shock to their system. And we dedicate the house, and we talk about the Lord, and we get in our trucks and we leave. And there's not a dry eye in the place. You know, Mel, I want you to come up and tell your story about what your experience was. But
are they part of the church, or do they just pick them randomly, or how do they work that?
You know, I don't know how they're chosen. I don't know what the...
I have a little information.
Okay.
One thing that they do is they will build one house for a Christian and they'll build one house for a non-Christian, and the builders are not told they're building for a Christian or non-Christian. Of the non-Christians they build the houses for, probably 80-90% of them become Christians and join the pastor's church that trusts them.
One of the really wonderful side benefits is the children in the neighborhood. We were just hanging out, and kids would swarm us. You know, they want to try our food, and they want to tell us where they live, and they're just wonderful, warm, terrific children. But you can tell, you know, this one, Ruth and I were playing with this one little boy. He must have been, what, 8, you think? And you could tell he really wanted some attention. I mean, his dad was at home, and mom was at home, but something was missing. He just clung to us like, take me home, you know, kind of feeling. But I'll tell you, it's a monumentally rewarding experience. Next time, please come. And I want, you talked a little bit about what, do you have anything else you want to say about it?
No.
Mel, why don't you come up?
Well, this is one dozen years I've been involved with this ministry, and I've probably been on 15 trips or so, you know, over the years, and it is an amazing experience. One other requirement of the families, at least one of the members of the family must have a job, and it's incredible. The typical pay for a factory worker down there is $50 to $65 a week, and that's a six-day work week, often 10 hours long. So that's what their income is.
And this guy is a bricklayer, so
yes.
Imagine laying bricks for 10 hours
right.
a day.
Right, and the wife worked in a factory, so you know the work ethic is amazing down there, and indeed the lot must be owned or they must be making payments on it, must have a job. Beyond that, the selection process is not really divulged to us, and I would certainly hate to be in that position because, needless to say, you start building a house in a neighborhood, and everyone would love to have a house like that. But our emphasis is that the Lord is providing this house. We are just working with him to provide this, and we don't expect anything in return for what we're doing. And the dedication is, of course, the highlight, but even long before that happens, there's interaction with the neighborhood, adults and children especially. And the ministry effort is obviously a very important part. And out of these 13-week studies, another thing, new churches are planted, or the individuals that go through the church are connected with existing churches in the neighborhood. And it doesn't end there. Baja Christian Ministry follows up with each and every one of the people that sign up for the course. And they follow up with the families as well, because many times they do not know Christ, and whether they do or do not, the invitation is made during the dedication, and in this particular case, both the husband and the wife and the older daughter profess their belief in Jesus as their Lord and Savior, and even though I've been doing this a dozen years now, I weep when that happens. It's just amazing evangelistic experience, and I wish in our neighborhoods we had people, you know, that open to at least hearing the message and at least given the opportunity to respond.
Yeah.
Tell them the different jobs that can be done as to how they can.
Well, there's really no building skills are required, and of course we invite anyone to come on, even if you had no building skills. But typically there's painting operation, the plywood siding is and trim is painted on the ground before the house is assembled, and so there's all kinds of tasks. But even drywalling, I mean, there were kids with drywall hammers, you know, nailing up drywall, and so we especially like it when families commit to come, because not only do we all and they all learn really skills that are valuable for life, but it provides an opportunity to interact with the neighborhood when you have families come.
And kids playing with kids.
The Russ Brown family was there with their kids, and little girl Jennifer, I think her name, was teaching the little kids how to do ring around the rosy, and basically spent time just hanging out with those kids, and it's just amazing. Kids seem to have a universal language in their play activities and interaction, and it's again, often we're busy framing and doing the work we need to get. That needs to be done to get the house done, but there's a lot more that goes on than just that experience. And even if you just come to hang out with the kids and the families that come to watch the process, then it's valuable to the ministry.
There's always more people than we really need.
That's true.
Yeah. But everybody finds
something
to do. Something
to do.
Yeah.
And so I certainly encourage others in our class and people to come. The website for the group from our church, Team CASA, is teamcasa.org, and there's pictures on there. And you can also go to BajaChristianMinistries.org and get some idea of what we build. These are actually 16 by 20 is the dimensions of the slab. So, but it's amazing. And actually, I think the existing house down there was, I measured it as only 6 by 6, because the twin bed filled up one side of it, and that was it. And of course, dirt floor. And so the contrast is amazing.
The house is like 3 rooms and then a loft room. So 4 rooms essentially.
That's right. Yeah.
So
we pack a lot into that. Yeah. Very impressive. Questions?
You can get a perspective.
Yeah.
Two by four.
Yeah.
Two by four. How big that is.
Yeah.
It's a good way to put it in perspective. Okay. I got some pictures I'm going to pass around. You guys can take a look at them.
Yes.
You build this house now, and I haven't been there, but is it in a neighborhood where everybody else is living in this small shack? If that's the case, is there a lot of envy that's created from the neighbors? What's the following interaction?
You don't really sense that, but yes, these neighborhoods, although they're outside of the central city, are really, most of them are pretty well built up with homemade living accommodations. And you see spotted all over the landscape in many of these community houses that we've built over the many years. And I've never really felt it. I mean, again, that the people are just so loving and supportive of each other. And yes, there is a lot of crime and fear and so forth. As Ross was saying, sometimes their little lot will have a fence across it and a gate to give them some sense of security. But at least in the daytime, I mean, there's a lot of activity in the neighborhood as far as games and other things and a lot of interaction. But it is basically a slum.
Yeah.
That there's no other way of really describing it. Yes. We wire the houses with electric. We put a ceiling fixture in each of the downstairs bedroom, one in the living room, and we put electrical plugs in. Most people down there steal electricity from the government-run utility, and it's amazing they don't get electrocuted, but they'll just attach to some of the overhead wires if they're nearby. If they're not, they'll run thousands of feet of wire across the desert floor to their home. They run one, if you know anything about electricity, all they run is one hot lead, then they pound in a ground rod to complete the connection. But generally, there's not a lot of moisture in the ground, so the voltage maybe gets down to about 40 or 50 volts, but it's enough to light a light and perhaps
maybe a refrigerator.
Maybe a refrigerator, although usually they have propane stoves. Now, no in some of the no plumbing is put in the house. We build an outhouse, a latrine. That's something new to the ministry. In fact, Dave Bauer and Bob Allen, that was their addition to what had traditionally been done on these houses. Indeed, a pit is dug. It's all lined with cement block. A concrete floor is put on, and a very nice potty put on, and you know, all enclosed and trimmed, and a vent system, and the whole works. And
used a lot, didn't it?
Yeah, it was luxury compared to what they have. But that's part of our ministry, is to add that level of hygiene of to the houses, because the hygienic conditions certainly aren't the greatest, but this does give them a very hygienic bathroom to use. And, yes.
Yeah, who supplies the materials for this? The second question is how, if a person wanted to volunteer, is it just a matter of you put your name on the list and they tell you when you're going to go and
yeah.
That's it?
Okay. Yes, the house building activities take place all year long. Of the ones associated with the church, we try to do two a year now, usually October and April are the two times. But the materials, it's just under $7,000 for all the materials for a house and some of the incidental things like nails and things of that nature. So that money is all raised. It's usually raised in advance of the trips. And, of course, that's another way anybody can get involved, is to donate money, even if you can't physically join us on these trips. But anyway, once we have the funds together to buy the materials, Baja Christian Ministry purchases all the materials in Mexico. And to ease the process a little bit, and plus hire local people, they work with a person that has a warehouse area, and all the materials are delivered to there, and much of the lumber is pre-cut to length and essentially made ready for assembly. Originally, we cut all that lumber on site, even the studs for the walls. So now what happens is, during the week ahead of the construction, all those materials, every last thing, including the roof shingles, is assembled for a particular house. The wood is cut to length, everything's counted out, all the wire is purchased, the lighting fixtures, plugs, and everything. And that's all delivered to the job site, usually the evening before we start, so it doesn't get, you know, stolen. And so when we arrive, all these materials are on site, ready for us to basically put up the house.
Hey, what was that website you mentioned for your first involvement?
TeamCasa.org.
There and then. Just a couple more, Mel.
Typically, water trucks deliver water to the neighborhood. It's rare indeed that there's water mains. I did notice a fire hydrant not too far away from this house, but basically the water is trucked in. There's no normal supply. They buy it from a truck, put it in a 55-gallon drum, and that's what they use for everything. So in some of the more developed neighborhoods, gradually water mains get put in, and there's actually domestic water supply, and then back here.
So this is in, did you say it's in Tijuana or outside of Tijuana?
Yes, most of the areas are south, and then slightly south, and then east and west of the main city, if you're familiar with it. There are areas that basically the government has set up to provide housing, but basically the government doesn't provide anything more than the lots, and indeed they have to purchase these relatively small lots.
Well, it really is it's a beautiful thing you're doing. I was just wondering, I think I may have some Hispanic blood in me. Is there any possibility you could build me a very cheap car? Very cheap. I don't even.
Right. Well,
you got to live in Mexico, though, Alan.
Yeah.
That's the rule.
See, but anyway, hopefully, in addition to the Lord working through us providing these wonderful houses, it does help the economics down there as far as purchasing these materials and in hiring locals to work in the warehouse area and the preparation. And plus, Baja does actually pay some of the local people to help with the construction as well. And so it's a very smooth operation, and the only thing that limits us from building more houses is indeed the financial resources. But God can provide and always has for our little effort here, and for that replicated, you know, hundreds of times with other church groups.
I'll turn it over to you so we can get to your lesson.
Okay. We got maybe one or two more questions. Yeah.
In spite of, you know, yeah, in spite of the recent events, I mean,
there you go, it's on now.
In spite of all the recent publicity, that should not be a concern. Of course, we pray for safety and ask you for the same thing. But over a dozen years, I've never had any type of incident. And yes, a little disconcerting when you have military people with automatic rifles, you know, alongside the road, and certainly the border security getting back into the U.S. Was a little more stringent this time, and we even had some of our border people with automatic weapons at the ready, which was a little bit surprising, because
yeah.
Once you get in the line to cross over the border, I don't know where you're going to go, but so you sort of sense it, but where we stay the night's a relatively safe area, and then we're on the job site, and there's not much happening out in the country where we're building these houses, and yes, occasionally you'll see drug buys going on and other things, but I would not.
The violence is so far away. It's kind of like somebody from France saying, "Hey, I heard about this shooting in Kentucky. Are you guys okay?" You know, it's like, there's some distance there. So,
But we certainly trust the Lord to keep us safe, and it's okay to be concerned, and certainly we are cautious in everything we do. But it's been so many years now, and we said no serious problems. You do need passports, not to get into Mexico, but to get back. So, Dick, do you have a question, Dick?
Okay. I want to say one thing real quick. I just want to give a kudos to Bob Allen and Dave Bauer, who are the people who go to this church, who have headed up Team CASA. And I asked Dave Bauer yesterday, how many houses do you think you've built? And he said he stopped counting at 200. So this church has built 200 houses down there. And when you looked out over the hillside where we were, the houses that we build have a distinctive look. They're all framed the same size. They're painted different colors, but they look the same. There was at least a dozen houses that this church has built along the little hillsides around where we were. Colleen? Ah, boy, it doesn't sound like the men get to do anything, eh? Ruth, why don't you come up? You have a really good story, and tell us what your experience was.
Hello. Is this working? Okay. Well, it was a wonderful experience for sure. As we're going to Tijuana, all through the neighborhoods, there were graffiti all over the houses. Doesn't matter if it was a nice-looking house or a slum house or businesses. Every single place, graffiti on every single wall. It doesn't matter if you're up on the hill and there's houses there, wherever you are. It's just graffiti. So I tried to feel safe. But, yeah, it was really good. As we're going through one of the neighborhoods, there was a business building with a Doberman dog on the roof, in the corner of the roof. And I'm looking, what's that dog doing way up there? And then I look right next to him, there was a dog house right next to him. I'm thinking that must be a guard dog looking down. I never saw anything like that before. As we gathered together on the foundation, we gathered and we held hands, we prayed. And then we were assigned to different parts of the building of the house. And most women were doing the painting. And as we started with the painting, some of the neighborhood kids started coming and observing. And And I just thought, oh, let's put them to work too. So there was a 15-year-old boy. He just approached me, and I said, do you want to paint that? And he's like, yeah. And then I looked at him. I'm like, oh, wow. He's wearing this skull shirt. He looked like a rocker, Metallica rocker. And he had this loop in his lip, a big loop. And he had this spiky glove. And I thought, and I said, no bueno. And he goes, bueno. Good. It's good. So, and I thought, okay, whatever. Let's put them to work. And they did a really good job. There was a girl and there were two boys. So we just made them paint each piece of wood. And then as that was happening, we were joking, we're laughing with the kids. And then the boy looks at me and says, in Spanish, I want that hat that I was wearing. I was wearing this brown cap. And I looked at him and I said, I want your loop out of your lip. And he looks at me like, are you crazy? And then he kind of was wondering, should he not? And then he said, okay. And then I said, okay, that spiky glove, I want that too. And then as soon as he said, okay, I said, before I give him my cap, I said, first of all, do you have another loop? Just in case he, you know, puts it back in. He goes, no. I said, okay, that case, I'm giving you my hat. So I give him the hat, and he wore it backwards. He loved that hat, and I said, okay, hand it over. He takes it out of his lip. He said, give it to me. Puts it in my hand. All parts of it. It was gross, but it doesn't matter. Infección. Okay. So once I got that spiky glove, and then the mom, she just came right in front of our car and sitting there with these necklaces that she wanted to sell, and I didn't know it was the mom, but she was like, bueno, sí, you know, get it from him. And when he first started looking at me like, oh, I don't know if I should give it or not, I said, tu cuerpo es Dios, like your body belongs to God, you know, you don't want infection in your mouth. And mom's like, yeah, sí. And said, that's why I said, since your body belongs to God, you shouldn't be piercing. So that's how we got him to get that out of him. And that boy that Ross was talking about that was very needy, while we were eating our lunch, there was like a house, it looks like a shell. There's nothing inside. This boy, just to get attention, he goes all the way to the top. He just climbs to the top of this house, and then he looks down like, catch me, and Ross is like, okay. So he just comes down and Ross is catching him, and it's just like they need a lot of attention. I went to that shack that the family was living in, and it was a single bed, but there was like the husband and wife are in that bed. And I asked, well, what about the four kids? And I asked the eldest daughter, and she said there's another shack, something in the back, where all four kids by themselves sleep in this little shack behind. And I just started talking to her inside her shack, and I was just looking, but she was happy. The kids were happy. But then I'm looking, and you see these wires coming in the from the top of their little ceiling shack, right in the middle, coming down, big wires. Like right over the bed area. I'm like, how can they survive like this? You know, and here they're going to now a beautiful home. It is like a palace. It is compared to what they had. So I just thank God for that. And I gave them bags of socks. And at the very end, it started raining. And then I thought, I'm looking down at their feet, all the children and the adults, flip-flops. And I'm like, they're not going to wear socks. It's muddy. They're not going to wear those socks, but maybe in their beds. But, you know, I start thinking, okay, culturally, I want to give them socks. But when you look at them, they don't need them. It's dirt. It's wet. It's muddy. So it's like you have to kind of match your thinking to theirs. Step into their shoes, literally. But and that was a good experience. I really enjoyed that. So I would definitely do it again. Easy.
So overall, what are you feeling now about the whole experience?
I want to go right back. I want to go right back and build up five more homes, and I want to be integrating myself with those families. I want to talk one-on-one with them. I want to go to the neighborhood kids, talk about God, anything I can do just to put a dent in their lives, spiritually speaking. I do love seeing their faces And, you know, we are totally new to them each time. Yeah, they know that Americanos are coming over, but we're still individual people that they enjoy talking with, playing with, you know, the children. It was good. I would definitely do it again. And it wasn't dangerous. Honestly, the guy who runs it, he said, like, over 40 years, the area is very safe, and nothing's happened. So, and it's up on a hill where we stayed.
Totally where safe. We stayed, we went out after dark and went down to the local 7-Eleven and wandered around.
There's a small group of us that did go down. I thought, should we do that? But it was totally safe.
What about that bar you two visited?
Stop!
While I waited across the street, I wouldn't do it.
Okay, hand it over.
Let's get on with the lesson. All right. I want to say one more thing before we get going. I'm going to need it. So I'm going to need it. I got things planned. So keep the volume up on it. One more thing. I got half an hour. 2 weeks ago, as you recall, I went to the Apologist Conference in North Carolina, hung out with you and a bunch of wonderful people. One of the things I learned is that there were people there from the Jacksonville chapter and the Charlotte chapter. And one of the guys from the Jacksonville chapter, I introduced myself, and he says, "I know you." I said, "No, you don't." He says, "Yes, I've heard you every Sunday or many Sundays on the Paradox website from this class." And he shook my hand and he said, "Those recordings are a lifeline to me." That's what he said, a lifeline. There are a lot of people, more than the people that are in this room, that benefit from you and his teaching and what we do in this class. And so they may be listening right now. So it's not on the web yet, but I want to say hello to my new friends in Jacksonville, and especially Jeremy and Charlotte. And if there's anybody out there that listens to this class that gets benefit from it that we don't know about, contact us at paradoxes.org. I'd really love to be able to read your stories right up here about how this benefits you. So there it is. And I want to show you this. How many of you know who Josh McDowell is? Josh McDowell was there, and he had the coolest T-shirt. I want to show you this. Intolerance is a beautiful idea. On the back. Mother Teresa was intolerant of poverty. Bono was intolerant of AIDS. Nelson Mandela was intolerant of apartheid. Martin Luther King was intolerant of racism. Jesus was intolerant of bigotry. So I got it. I'm bigger than he is. I was actually wearing it this morning when I was hanging out at the coffee shop working on the talk, and it got at least one conversation. So it's a good shirt. Okay, near-death experiences. The near-death experience is an experience of people who, in many cases, have been declared dead on an operating table or in an ambulance. They experience certain things. Oftentimes it's light. They see light. They experience coming out of their body, and usually it's into another kind of body somehow. There's often a tunnel involved. There's sound. There's a person. Many times they equate this person with Jesus or the creator of the universe. Time is compressed for them. That's what they talk about. Now, near-death experiences have actually been happening for a long time. In Plato's Republic, Plato describes a near-death experience. But they're more prevalent now because we have all of these medical ability to bring people back from near death. So many people who have been declared dead on an operating table, they have a near-death experience, and they come back to life, we think, into their bodies, and continue to live for some period of time. Now, they're often profoundly affected by this. It changes their life. Carl Jung talked about a near-death experience. atheist A.J. Ayer has talked about a near-death experience. Now, my feelings about near-death experience as an apologetic tool for a long time up until about a year ago was it's pretty soft. There's a lot of possible explanations for these kinds of things. How do you turn it into a scientific, rational apologetic? Some of the objections that you could easily bring up. You could say that they're caused by a hallucination, some kind of shock to the brain. Some people have said it's anoxia, which is oxygen starvation. Some people say it's elevated levels of CO2, which is hypocarbia, endorphins. There's all kinds of theories out there. But there's two things to keep in mind. Number one, many of these people have no brain activity at all while these experiences are taking place. And they have no heartbeat, so they are clinically dead. But still, you would think that it's just not specific enough. How do you turn this into an apologetic? I was unconvinced until I started reading about near-death experiences, which include out-of-body experiences, where patients describe specific events which they could not have known otherwise, unless what they were saying was true. And I want to read a few of these to you. There's two books where I got a lot of this from, and I've gotten a lot of stuff otherwise, but one of the guys that was at the conference wrote this book, Dinesh D'Souza, Life After Death. And this other one, God the Evidence, by Patrick Glynn. So I want to read a couple of these, because I can't say them as well as they can be. Yes? Okay. Well, if you my brother works in the medical field. Yeah. My brother's a respiratory therapist, and he says if you talk to the nurses that work in these operating rooms, it's really common. In another case, a woman provided a detailed and medically accurate account of her lumbar disc surgery, performed with the patient in a prone position. One of the details that she claimed to have noticed and reacted to with some surprise is that the chief resident in neurosurgery, whom she hadn't seen before the operation, actually performed the procedure rather than her own attending surgeon, as she had expected. The researcher checked her medical record. Sure enough, while her chart before the operation was annotated in the hand of her attending surgeon, the actual report of the surgery was written by the chief resident along with all subsequent markings on her charts. Okay, here's another one. In another instance, a man reported leaving his body and traveling down the hall, seeing his wife, his eldest son, and his daughter, who had arrived at the hospital on a surprise visit in the midst of the man's cardiac arrest. The interviewer interviewed the wife separately. Indeed, she reported that she was startled to learn the next day from her husband that he knew of her presence. He was already in the midst of a code 99 when she arrived. She was also further surprised that he knew precisely who had accompanied her to the hospital, since she tended to visit the hospital in the company of different family members each time she came. Okay. Here's another couple. Ernest Hemingway. Wounded by shrapnel in World War I and lying in the hospital bed in Italy, wrote to a friend that on a fateful night in 1918, a huge bomb exploded in the darkness. I died then. I felt my soul or something coming right out of my body, like you'd pull a silk handkerchief out of a pocket by one corner. It flew around and then came back and went in again, and I wasn't dead anymore. That's his quote. One 11-year-old boy who suffered cardiac arrest, these are the best two, I think, and had no heartbeat, told of an out-of-body experience in which he could see the doctors and nurses working on his body. After his recovery, he accurately summarized the resuscitation procedures used on him, the colors and whereabouts of the instruments in the room, and even what the medical staff said to each other. Another remarkable case involved a Seattle woman who reported a near-death experience following a heart attack. She told a social worker that she had separated from her body and not only risen to the ceiling, but floated outside the hospital altogether. The researcher did not believe her, but a small detail the woman mentioned caught her attention. The woman said that she had been distracted by the presence of a shoe on the third floor ledge at the north end of the emergency room building. It was a tennis shoe with a worn patch and a lace stuck under the heel. The woman asked the researcher to go find the shoe. The researcher found this ridiculous because she knew the woman had been brought into the emergency room at night when she could not possibly see what was outside the building, let alone on a third floor ledge. Somewhat reluctantly, the researcher agreed to check, and it was only after trying several different rooms, looking out several different windows, and finally climbing out onto the ledge that she was able to find and retrieve the shoe, exactly as was described. This is different.
Well, I kind of wonder what's the distinction, if there is one, between these near-death out-of-body experiences and out-of-body experiences that people try to work with within their lives. Like my oldest son was for a while into trying to achieve out-of-body experiences.
Like transcendental meditation and that kind of thing?
And this story seemed very similar as far as being able to accurately predict things going on during that time and that sort of thing. Going different places and whatnot.
Well, I think, sort of as a side here, I think it's possible to do that. It probably comes from the dark side, from a bad source, to be able to do that. I mean, there's nothing in the Bible about God wanting us to be able to do that. But maybe there is a spiritual way through the occult to achieve that. Yes, John.
I read recently that 18 hospitals have engaged in a project in which they're suspending pictures upside down from the ceiling in operating rooms because this phenomenon has been reported so widely and they're going to test it. They won't say what's been learned so far, but they find a release result.
Well, yeah. There's a lot of research being done. So, what I want to say is, Al.
Yeah, I think scientists have been exploring this from 1888 or something like that. And they've come to the conclusion that it's not supernatural. You know, it's what you mentioned. I myself, I don't know, I've told people here that when I was younger, I went on a drinking binge and I saw I had to learn things where I saw visions that were so real that I could have sworn my life on it, you know. So, but it's kind of like a mystery. I mean, look at all the stuff on TV right now, movies. You know, they got zombies.
Al, I'm going to cut you off because I've got a little time yet, but I'm going to make a bold statement. I'm going to conclusively prove you wrong in the next 20 minutes, okay? Many do, and many become Christians. Yes.
Muslims see
them okay.
Also. And they,
yes.
A,
I'm getting there. All right. I want to say, I'm going to make this statement. I believe that this is conclusive evidence that a spiritual world exists. Now, I want to do an experiment. I'm going to show the class some slides. Can you guys kill those lights? I'm just going to describe the slides for those people who aren't here. And I don't want you to really do anything. Just take a look at them. Try to pay attention to what they are. Some of them are way pixelated, so I'm sorry, but you see what you see. Okay, here we have a slide of, what does it say on there? 2323. What is that? Crescent. I think it's a crescent earth. Crescent something.
Tiger.
Face of a tiger. Painting of some flowers. Here's a dead clown with some vultures, and it says, "Tastes funny." All right. There's a out of focus kitchen sink. That's why it's out of focus. No. All right. I don't know. I have no clue what alien creature that is. I think it's a hairless cat in some kind of stress. What does it say? Open.
In red.
Somebody say, tell me what that is. Thank you. Yeah, it looks very, very dated. And a pumpkin with George Bush's face on it. Okay. All right. I want to do a little experiment here. I want to call Mark Perez up here. And we can turn the lights back on. I promise it. I'll embarrass you. Yes.
Thank you. Okay.
All right.
Yes, I'm starting to squeal myself.
All right, let me ask you, did anybody observe whether Mark was watching these slides or not?
I was watching the slides.
Good, you were watching the slides. Okay. All right. Do you know that he saw them?
No.
Okay. Mark?
I was asleep, I was dead.
Yes. Did you see the slides?
Yes.
Prove it. What did you see?
One of the slides had 2323 on it, or some numbers like that. One of them, the one that I liked the most, had a clown, and there's some vultures grazing on him, and said, this tastes funny. I found that was good. That was very good selection.
Yeah. How did the crowd respond to that?
They laughed.
Okay.
And he laughed even more.
Okay, at this point, is there anybody that is not convinced that Mark saw these slides? Is there anybody that needs more proof? Okay, give him more proof.
What more proof could you ask for?
You could have had your eyes closed and heard our responses.
Yeah.
That's true. There was one slide up there that was an abstract slide, and it was orange, and then had two slivers that looked like blue and white in it. I might have gotten the colors wrong, but nobody ever talked about that slide. That was too abstract, and nobody gave it any kind of descriptive characterization. So I saw that and I didn't hear anybody mention anything about that except somebody said something about it being the 70s or something.
Was this the first time you've seen it?
Yes, this was the first time I've seen the slides.
Okay.
What color was the hairless cat?
I didn't see the color of the hair. I don't remember. I think it was there was some weird looking creature that was kind of a tan looking color, but
yeah.
I didn't recognize it as a hairless cat.
It was.
It was?
Okay.
There's Alan.
I believe.
You know what? I'm asking the question. You're supposed to do this.
Oh, it's going fine.
Okay.
I just want you to prove to the class, beyond anyone's doubt, that you saw the slide.
Alan's doubting, or else he's just having a hand problem.
I believe that he saw everything that he said he saw, because he's a policeman, and policemen never lie.
Thank you.
Sign him up for the force.
Sign him up for the city council.
City council?
Yeah.
All right.
I have a ticket you might want to fix.
How many slides would you say there were?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not good at counting slides.
Take a guess.
Nine.
Okay. There were 10 slides. Now, let me ask you.
LA School District victim.
Because Mark said there were 9 instead of 10, is there any doubt that he still saw the slides?
No.
You're convinced. Okay. Now, let me ask the class while you're up here, is there any other explanation that you can think of that's reasonable for how Mark knew what we saw other than that he actually experienced it himself?
He was somehow able to see the vision of the slide before the class slide so that he could see it also.
Okay, let me ask you then. If that was true, is it possible that those images were generated inside his head?
No.
My head's too small for that.
Okay. Okay.
Only if he's intentionally trying to deceive us is it possible.
Given that everything Mark is saying is true, that he's never seen the slides before, which he hasn't, and all the questions you're asking him, his answers are true. Given those things, is there any other way that he could know what these slides were? Can anyone think of a rational...
Well, you mentioned the cat, and you mentioned that those colors...
No,
that looked
But I didn't mention the colors on the abstract. And he mentioned... Okay. Gloria?
If he was in contact with supernatural, be it God or Satan, could use certain aspects to...
Okay, but my basic question, and where I want to go with this is it possible that Mark could have had an hallucination? Is it possible that he could have been on drugs? I mean, that may be possible anyway, but, you know, can drugs explain the fact that he was able to relate what he saw on the screen?
No.
Alan?
Well, I would say that if he was on drugs or hallucination, then we all were, I suppose. So.
Well, even if we all were, doesn't the fact that we all had the same hallucination mean that the source has to be outside of us? Or the chances of us having the same hallucination are astronomically small.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to draw a conclusion from this. Let's see if everybody can agree with this. And Mark, you're the philosopher, so you tell me if this is a reasonable conclusion. If someone experiences something that corresponds with reality, that experience cannot originate from inside that person's mind. Fair enough? Mark, would you agree with that?
Two thumbs up on that.
Two thumbs up. Thank you very much for your your attention.
Can I go back to my rap?
You may. Yes, thank you. All right. Let's take what we just learned here and go back to the near-death experiences. What did we have? We had people experiencing things from directions and angles that their body was not in. Seeing things that they could not have seen even if they were awake on the operating table that corresponded to reality. They were true. They were real. They could not have come from inside that person's head. There is only one explanation, and that is that the near-death experiences where people experience reality, real things that can be corroborated later, the only explanation is that they really had a near-death experience. They really did leave their body and come out and see those things and go back into their body.
Just one problem. First of all, could everybody do what Mark did? And my response to that would be no. Secondly, is we do not fully understand or even have a little inkling on what the mind's capable of doing. It doesn't have to be an out-of-body experience. There could be, and I don't want to get into the Star Trek thing, but with all the brain power that's in here concentrating on this, could there have been a message that's there that Mark has the ability to pick up? I mean, this is just a...
It's Star Trek.
No, it's not Star Trek, because they have done some studies. But what I'm saying is that it doesn't have to be an out-of-body.
Okay, well, let me tell you.
I mean, he would know if he was out of body.
Right, but let me ask you, the person that saw the tennis shoe on the roof of the hospital, okay, they saw that from an angle from above the hospital. That means there was some way in which a conscious being was seeing photons of light at a particular angle and remembered that.
Yeah, but this has happened to people that were not near death experiences. This has happened to people in dreams. This has happened to people in... I mean,
well,
I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm saying there's many ways it can happen.
I agree with that, but I would argue if those are real, then people are somehow leaving the body for some period of time to perceive it. How else could you see the tennis shoe from above the hospital and know that it was there? John?
The fact that they saw that, let's say a tennis shoe, for example, shows that the source of information has to be from outside the person's body.
That's my point.
It could be from God. It could be from Satan, hypothetically. But even if you say somehow they were in tune with some vibrations of the universe, which is somewhat absurd, that's still a source outside the body. And it was when they were dead, and therefore you're talking about immaterial reality.
Right, but they're not saying this came to them. They're saying they were there.
Yeah.
They experienced being where they could see these things. I got so little time to finish this, so just Alan, really quick.
This
yeah, I can. I'll stay longer.
This sounds really, really, really out there. But what What if that lady planted that shoe there, then had the operation? After the operation said, I saw a shoe, just to create a hoax or create...
Alan, you're right. I didn't think of that. And, you know, that explains all the hundreds of others just like this. It's a conspiracy. That's it. Okay. All right. Yes. Yeah, they say these people are saying it's not like a dream, it's not like a vision, it's like being there. Okay, so I want to make this claim. It looks like we have found clear scientific evidence for the existence of the soul. John.
That the consciousness may well be independent of the body, and that when these experiences occur, it indicates that there may be a different perceptual mode. You mentioned photons. I'm not sure it's even photons. There might be some other means of perception.
Well, but given what we know about science, they are perceiving the light that we perceive.
Well, they report the objects and all that, whether it's light or not. I mean, you said it was dark, but
but my point is, even if that's true, even if it's some other method of transmission, they still had to be there to perceive it.
Yes, and their consciousness apparently is independent of the body. It's something
right.
Separate.
Okay, now, this is an argument. Tim, you had your hand up.
Yeah,
make it quick.
Kind of getting back to bringing this to what Q is always kind of putting forth to us, that we only make conclusions about things we see in the universe based on laws of physics that we know. We don't want to invent new physics or presuppose
that's right.
Things that we don't know anything
about. So let's
about.
Assume they're photons.
We have to presume that when we're making rational, concrete conclusions about things that we see here in reality, that they have to be explainable by the laws of physics, unless we want to invoke, say, there's a reason why God had us doing something like that. And I want to kind of caution us about trying to suppose too many things that we are basing on physics that we don't know exists or that is contradictory to physics we know of.
Okay. Al, I'll get to you, but I want to keep going. I believe this is not an argument. My argument for the existence of a soul is not an argument like many of Hugh's arguments where it's a preponderance of evidence. Where the more fine-tuning evidence that Hugh comes up with, the more the chance that there is a creator and not natural forces that created the universe. Every time he comes up with a new argument, he's building the skyscraper a little taller. This is a skyscraper by itself. All you need is one verified example, just one, of somebody experiencing something that they could not have experienced that corresponds to reality. To topple the whole edifice of the idea that there is no soul. Okay? Now, I want to go through some of the implications of this in my mind in 4 minutes. All right. What are the implications of the existence of a spiritual realm? Number one, clearly, the physical world is not all that exists. And what is it that Carl Sagan tells us? What is it they tell us? The universe is all there ever was, all there is, all there ever will be. It's done. We are partly spiritual. Okay? Now, it's possible, I suppose, that maybe we're completely physical now, but when we have an out-of-body experience, we transfer into some spiritual mode. But isn't it more likely that the spiritual mode is with us all the time? Okay. We are partly spiritual. What does this say about the idea of the image of God? We are created in God's image, the Bible says, 3,000 years ago. What is God? What are we partly?
Supernatural.
Our consciousness is not contained completely within our physical bodies. Is that a reasonable assumption? These people that had these experiences, their consciousness simply continued from their bodies to their out-of-body experience, back to their bodies. It was seamless. It was as if they left their body, saw their body, continued on with consciousness, went back into their body. So our consciousness is not completely contained within our physical bodies. Therefore, likewise, our memories are not contained completely within our physical bodies. These people remember events during a time when they had no neural paths to put them into the memory in their brains. How do you explain that? The idea that there are beings that are only spirit, that are then are only spiritual, is more plausible. It's one of the places where I really stumble. I talk to people who aren't Christians, and they say, "Well, do you believe in angels and demons?" And yeah, of course. Hey, those Lakers are playing great, aren't they? It's a tough one. This makes it a lot more plausible. If we can transfer to a spiritual realm and back again, maybe there's beings that simply live in that realm. The idea that we survive our bodies is more plausible. Now, we don't know. No one has come back from a total death experience, only near-death experiences. But the idea that we continue because of these near-death experiences is a much more plausible idea.
Well, Lazarus did, but we didn't get an explanation of where
that's right. All of this makes the biblical worldview much more plausible. What does the Bible say? We are spiritual. We are not just our bodies. We do survive the grave. Very interesting, isn't it? If you're using this as an apologetic, this book that was written 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, tells us about what we're just discovering now. This is the end of the naturalistic paradigm. I'm going to make this bold prediction. Hang on. Stephen Hawking and his theory of everything. What is a theory of everything? It means that if you know the initial conditions of the universe and you know the physical laws that govern the universe, you should be able to predict every motion of every string, every atom, until the end of the universe, you know how it's going to end. Okay? Let me give you an example. If I have a beaker here and it's full of water with a certain amount of water in it, and I know the ambient temperature in the room, and I've got a burner under it that's giving out certain BTUs of energy, I can predict how long it's going to take for that water to boil. But what happens if there's a secondary heat source or somebody throws an ice cube in it? Okay? Stephen Hawking's theory of everything only works if it's a closed system, if there's nothing else affecting the system. Well, here we have evidence. Here it is. People leave their bodies. They come back. There's communication. There is an effect. People know things. Their brain is wired differently when they come back from the near-death experience than when they went, and you can't explain that with any physical laws. It invalidates the idea that science only investigates natural phenomena. Eugenie Scott is a person that Hugh has debated, and one of her quotes is, "Science restricts itself to natural causes." Well, what does that mean? If somebody spent 20 years investigating with a very disciplined scientific methodology a particular phenomenon and came to the conclusion that that phenomenon was miraculous and they can't explain it, does that mean their whole 20 years of methodology wasn't scientific? No, it's ridiculous. Well, here we have it. We have confirmed, documented cases using a careful scientific method of many, many, many hundreds of near-death experiences, and what do we wind up with? A completely unexplainable explanation, unexplainable from a naturalistic viewpoint. You cannot explain the spiritual world you can't explain it from a scientific outlook, but you can't. It looks like we can prove that it's there. Yeah.
But still, the scientific method does not address that. So I'm not sure if that statement is true.
If you read something in Scientific American or you read something in a reputable journal, we tend to believe the results of those outcomes without going and doing the experiment ourselves. If it's really true that there are documented cases, and what I read you was just the tip of the iceberg. There are people who have gone into this, complete skeptics, and said, I am going to analyze this and look at it as scientifically as possible, and they came out believing it is true. There's lots of books. There's a book that's referenced by both of these books that was written in 75 called Life After Life, where the guy is a doctor, and he was a skeptic, and he went into this, and he did controlled, you know, it was very controlled, and people were saying things that they couldn't have known otherwise.
Sure. I'm not disputing that.
Okay.
You can conclude that the events are true, that you can conclude that the soul is reality.
Okay.
But the scientific method does not address how do we explain that.
That's right.
And so the statement on the previous slide says is contrary to that.
Well, that statement, we're refuting that statement. That's someone you has debated. I'm disagreeing with that statement. That's the statement of an atheist.
Scientific process has to have proofs.
Okay.
Science has to prove.
Dave, is there any reason we can't stick around for another few minutes? Or
if you take a pause, there are people that need to get children, there's people that need to do other things, and sometimes they're comfortable getting up in the middle of discussions. So if you want to take a short 1 minute, 1 minute, 30 second break,
that's fine. I have about 10 minutes to finish. How many people want to stay? Okay, let's take 1 minute. Yeah, if you need to leave, then please feel free to go. And you can argue with me next week. Hang on, Al. We'll just take a minute and then I'll... A not gone. So there is direction, the communication in that direction. Some people, many people say that they see their loved ones as part of the process. And so it's reasonable to think that their loved ones are seeing them. So there's communication in both directions. There is some communication. It's limited, but it's in both directions. John?
Of course, you would agree, I'm sure. You've got to take great precaution in the loved one routine.
Yes, I know that.
Sometimes they see the dead Uncle Harry and says there is no God, you know. So
yes.
You've got to be careful about that.
Okay. Near-death experiences that we can document that make sense, the ones that are specific that I'm talking about, seems to me that it makes the other parts of the near-death experiences more plausible, where they do see their loved ones, where they do see Jesus, where there is light, where there is sound, where they seem to be going through a tunnel. The tunnel and the light seem to be generic to anybody who's ever had to many people who have had a near-death experience from all kinds of cultures. So, I don't think that, even though it's kind of nonspecific, I don't think that can be explained by anoxia or hallucinations or any of the other explanations. It's part of the reality that they're seeing. I think this affects the abortion issue. Think about it on the other end. We are created in our mother's womb. At some point in this process, a soul is imparted to us, or in some way we are soulish and physical. Now, when does that happen? Does it happen at conception? Does it happen 3 months later? We don't know, so let's err on the side of caution and assume it happens at the point of conception when our DNA is assembled and we become who we are.
Being soulish is not mean spirit.
I think I'm mixing those a little. That's true.
Yeah. Okay, so the
spiritual soul is what he means.
Well, okay. So I mean, we have the soul.
Right.
We have soulish animals.
I'm gonna let's say spiritual. There is a spiritual side to us. There is a spiritual world. We are partly spiritual.
Okay, then so I was a little confused also. The evidence that. These out-of-body experiences, but that said that we had a soul. So when you have a soul, then I want to know, well, what are the characteristics of a soul?
Okay, I'll change that to we have a spirit.
But even if you don't change it, there's still a question.
Yeah, the Hugh's definition of a soul means that you have a will, emotions, the ability to bond to one another,
Personality. But I would say aren't those things out of body experiences? I mean, in the sense that they are not. I mean, those ideas
are not contained within us physically. But they're not
spiritual.
We've talked about this. But that they've been proven, obviously, you can have dolphins and gorillas that have a higher IQ than say a child that has a mental handicap. And yet those are not capable of spiritual worship. But we have children in this church that are severely handicapped, have a very low IQ, but they come to this church and they worship, like an animal can. And so it's been proven, obviously, that, again, a soul means that these people are incapable of worship, whereas you have a spirit that's capable of worship.
I never thought of consciousness. But that's when consciousness starts. I think it's when the thing about the fetus. But the other thing is that but science, in order to make it a fact, it has to be verifiable and testable. They can't, unless they have been through that, it's an out-of-body experience, a near death. Also, they can do that by electrodes. They can put those, they can make those emotions and all those things happen by tweaking certain parts of your brain.
But so you can't tweak certain parts of your brain and perceive things where you aren't.
I'm sure there's some mystery to it, too, that hasn't been explained.
Do I hear faith, Al?
No, it's mystery. You know,
you're a man of great faith.
First, let me say two things. First of all, science does not deal with things that are only with things that are repeatable. Otherwise, you'd have to throw out every historical science that exists. Secondly, these are repeatable because you can do controlled experiments. Al can say, I don't believe it, and set up a test and go to the hospitals and say, I want to interview people that claim to have near-death experiences, and you can make sure that they really had no way of observing those things when they came out of the anesthetic.
I'm going to die pretty soon. I want to get wired up, and I'll come and tell you.
Okay. There's one, I think I missed the slide on it, but it also affects our identity. Who are we? If we really have a spirit, we are not just our bodies. Who am I? I'm not just tall and left-handed and scared to talk in front of people.
Okay. Don't forget handsome.
Thank you, Al. Thank you. I'll give you the $10 for that after class. We are also a spirit. There is an identity to us that is beyond our physical bodies. Marlene?
What about the difference between the Christian experience and the non-Christian? They all seem to have the same experience.
No.
Or are all of these experiences non-Christian?
No. There's another side to it that I didn't have time to get into, but I'll mention it. Most near-death experiences seem to be a positive experience, but there are many, many people who have hellish near-death experiences. They are terrified. They think they are literally seeing hell, and they come back absolutely petrified. Some of them so much so that they forget the experience, but they talk about it in these books.
I like where you're coming from as using this as an apologetic for a soul. However,
spirit.
Before you started trying, I have a big aversion to this because remember that lady came out, that Edie, she was a Mormon, went and saw the Mormon God. She wrote that whole book, Dave probably knows, very popular in the 80s. And most people, I like using it as apologetic, but most people, like those people you say, oh, watch, if you ask them that they believe in ghosts, it's mostly in the occult and the New Age that they believe this stuff.
Right.
And they have these experiences and so on and so forth. So that gives me an aversion to it. It doesn't seem... However, sitting here thinking about that, because we do have a spirit, it's like the... And I believe it's mainly demonic and people who are into the occult and all this stuff.
You mean the other kinds, the ones while we're living, or you think the near-death...
I mean, all the ones that I know of, or even if they ask for a project and all that, that's all getting into the occult. Now, most people will look at that, normal, rational people like me, and say, oh, this is all bull, okay? But that's why I like your idea of using that as the soul thing. However, then I'm sitting here thinking, well, isn't that interesting? If it is used within the occult and the New Age, isn't that the devil really trying to say to most rational people, oh, that's garbage. Like me, that's garbage, you know, just leave it alone. But not, but that's like the great deceit again. He's using it within this to make people think it's hogwash and Art Bell and it keeps us away from really looking at your point that we do have a soul.
Yeah.
So I
okay.
Kind of
Ruth?
We can just correlate this straight to the Bible where John was in the spirit. He had that outer body experience himself in Revelation. And he used his senses. He saw things. He heard. Even talked to the elder and they had a conversation back and forth. He was in the spirit, just like the people in the hospital who were in the spirit.
Yeah. John?
I was thinking that we can expect the occult people to seize on this and distort it just like they
sure.
do everything else.
Right.
To try to prove that they can overcome the threat of death of which they're subconsciously aware and yet exclude the biblical God. That's just normal.
I want to make a statement that I think is what I believe because I'm sitting here thinking about it while you guys are talking about it. I think near-death experiences of the type that I'm talking about where people are near death, literally near the end of their life, and something happens, they leave their body, they come back. I would not say that those are necessarily satanic or from the dark side. I would say probably any other way that you leave your spirit, you leave your body and go to a spiritual world while you're alive is probably a satanic process or source. Okay, this next slide is what Stephen Hawking is going to look like when he recognizes the implications of this argument. All right. There's one other thing I want to talk about, and it's a whole other topic in regards to this, but there are many cases of people who have been blind 10 years, 20 years, who have near-death experiences and see just like they saw when they could see. It's just like they were seeing it, they say. I had the verse, I was ready to go with it, and then I lost it and I didn't have time to find it, but in Isaiah, where is that verse that says, the deaf will, at the end times, the deaf will hear, the blind will see? Isn't that interesting? If you lose your physical senses on earth, when we get to the spiritual world, we will have them restored. And here's some evidence of it. Some people have been blind since birth. They had never seen before. They had a near-death experience, and they were terrified. They said, is this what seeing is?
Is it possible? If you're blind and or deaf, when you dream, do you think would a blind person be able to see in their dream?
It's a great question. I have no clue.
I do.
Do you? Okay.
I have not always been blind, that is true. But I see things and can read things in dreams sometimes. And sometimes I'm the same as I am in the real world in dreams. But there are times when I'm not.
Yeah, I've talked to a few blind people, and what happens, obviously, when they've been blind, is because you can't see their memories of objects, you know, go away, and so the further time goes by, the less they can visualize what it looked like when they saw, you know, and so that's been my
experience. That makes sense.
With blind people. I've asked that question to blind people before, to several people that have been blind, you know, 10, 20 years, and what they said is that as time goes by, of course, they can't remember, you know, and then one guy I talked to said, I can't remember what my wife's face looks like, he said well, the toughest thing was he couldn't remember, was after being married and a blind for 10, 20 years, he couldn't remember what his wife looked like, what she looked like on her wedding day. And so those images just go away because you're not reinforcing it.
Wow. I want to say something personal at this point. I'm basically done with the near-death experience talk. I want to say that I've been a Christian my whole life. I was in a Christian home. I accepted the Lord when I was 7. But I really drifted for a long time. I never rebelled. I just kind of floated. And there have been two things that have changed me. The first was seeing a book on a coffee table at my aunt and uncle's in Los Gatos by this guy named Hugh Ross. And I think it was in 1999, it was The Fingerprint of God, and I picked it up and I thought, there's something here. These are the kind of questions I've been asking and nobody's had an answer for. And over a period of about a year or two, I bought a few of his books and was reading the newsletter and found out that this class existed and have been attending this class ever since. But I want to say that the intellectual...